Good morning. I would like to talk about ceremonies today because I just went through a big ceremony. I gave transmission to Fish Barbara Murphy last week. And as I look around, I realize, well, not everybody was here when I gave my last talk about what does transmission mean, especially this ceremony, because it's a private ceremony. Most of our ceremonies, the whole Sangha and other people and relatives and everybody is invited to. But the last ceremony, no one's invited to. It's a private ceremony. And I think whenever anything's private, there's a lot of curiosity that goes on behind the scenes. So I thought today maybe I could talk a little bit about that. And then I thought, well, maybe I have to back way up and just talk about why do we do ceremonies in the first place. Some of the Buddhist lineages have cut out ceremonies. The biggest one, although many Zen places have cut out ceremonies now. And the Vipassana, when one of the major Vipassana groups, you know, Spirit Rock and IMS, when they went to Thailand to study, it was full of ceremonies. But when they came back to America, whatever it was, 40 years ago or 30 years ago, they took away the ceremony because they said that Americans didn't like ceremonies, or it was too Asian, or it was too traditional, or it reminded us too much of our childhood religions. Ugh! For us converts, right? So they stripped it. Like if you go to, I adore Common Ground, so I'm not putting it down at all. I think it's a beautiful practice center. But if you go there, they don't have that many rituals because they're in that tradition where they took away the ritual. And the Tibetans also, although I think in general the Tibetans have kept their tradition, their traditional rituals, and sometimes are more than ours. We're all don't quite know what to do with the elaborate rituals. Now there are elaborate rituals in Western religions as well. Catholicism has a lot of ritual. Jews have a lot of ritual, except for the really reformed. We can just go through and say that there are different strains in all the religion of how much ritual people want. And I was just thinking about, while we were sitting, Reb Anderson calls Zazen or meditation, a ceremony of Zazen is what he calls it. Because it's a form, an ancient form, that we put our bodies into, and then we get something from it. And even this talk, I say, wow, gee, I bowed. Is that important to bow before I speak? Or we do the gata. This is very, very rare, the gata says, to hear the Dharma. So what does that do to what you're hearing now? And we've talked about, oh, we shouldn't do it anymore. It's too, we say, it turns Americans off, bowing and chanting. And yet we don't seem to get rid of it, at least at Clouds and Water. Because something happens in the process of doing that little ritual that changes me as the speaker and you as the listeners. And in this, all of the ceremonies you have to prepare for. I keep wanting to stick out my tongue. Because preparing is hard. So those of you who did Jukai, which is the Buddhist initiation, the first ceremony that we do. And that requires you take a year. It depends on where you go, of course. But here, it's a year of studying. And then it's, what would you say, 4 months of sewing. And many people haven't even ever sewed before. It's a real trial and tribulation. And why? Why should you do that? And then we have the ceremony, which is an old ceremony. It has Asian flair to it. Why would an American want to do that? And yet, I've done it. I've done quite a few Jukais. And most people say it was very profound, or it was a deep thing that happened. And I watch it happen. Surrendering to the process, and then doing the process, and then inviting people over. Maybe you haven't told some people that you're a Buddhist, and then all of a sudden you have this ceremony, and then you wear this thing. But underneath, something happens to you. That's what I've observed. And I fight within myself. Oh, let's get rid of the rituals. I don't want to wear this anymore. So what I'm wearing is, well, my underwear is American. But the shirt and the, I forget what this is called, kimono, the juban is the shirt, and the kimono are Japanese. The black thing is Chinese, and this is Buddha's robe that all Tibetans, Vipassana, everybody, maybe different colors, right? But everyone wears a Buddha's robe. So the whole tradition, the whole history of Buddhism, I'm wearing. India to China to Japan to America. And then I say, well, do you want to throw that out? You know, should we throw it out? So I don't know if we should or we shouldn't. But what I notice is it has a meaning. The ceremonies have a meaning, and we need it. And it's the same with community. Our culture, in a way, we are so lonely. I'm speaking generally. I hope you're not lonely and alienated. I hope that's true for you. But, you know, people come and see me, person after person after person. And I realize, oh, our culture doesn't make you feel very whole. W-H-O-L-E, inside. There's kind of a loneliness, or we crave community. And yet, this gesture, I want it and I don't want it. And yet we're very skeptical of community. We're very, I don't know, maybe skeptical or suspicious, think we're going to get hurt, those kind of feelings. So what we're doing here is rather difficult, because what we're doing is trying to make a loving community where you feel whole, and we're trying to have these ceremonies, even just the Sunday ceremony, where you feel like you enter a deeper space in your life, And you do it through these little things that we do that make you have an entrance into a deeper way of feeling the moment. And I was talking about preparation. There's a lot of preparation for transmission ceremony. Just because Fish just did it, I'll talk about her. You have to sew two robes. A 7-row and a 9-row robe. The 9-row is lined, so it makes it even more complicated. And you have to sew another rakusu. So those of you who have sewed one rakusu can have sympathy for having to sew 3 huge garments by hand. Of course, you get help, and it's a community project. It's community helps you, but nevertheless, that's a lot of work. Then you chant the names of the ancestors at least once a day for a month or two before the ceremony. And sometimes people do it 3 times a day. So I don't know if you've ever come on Sunday morning, but it's a pretty long list. And you're supposed to bow at every ancestor. And if you're Reb's student, he's the strictest so far that I found. You do that 3 times a day. That's 83 names, 3 times a day. Bow, 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 bow. And then now we add the women. So you can add another 30 names. And both Fish and I were quite moved that this ceremony has survived. I pretty much know that it's, you can go back to Dogen. So he's 13th century. We're doing the same ceremony that they did in the 13th century. But the transmission ceremony has gone longer than that, of course. The first transmission was Buddha to Mahakashapa. And that was very non-institutionalized, the first one. Right? You know the story, Buddha twirled the flower and Mahakashapa smiled. That was supposed to be the transmission. That's very poetic and mythological. So in a way, we love it. But in a way, it gives a quite unrealistic idea of what transmission is. Because Mahakashapa had probably been begging and walking and following Buddha for years before that moment happened. So the mythological stories are wonderful, and I'm so glad we have them because they're quite uplifting. But sometimes they give us an unrealistic idea of what spiritual life is like. So, in our tradition, oh, he's not here. Would you help me flip this over? I'm sorry, my arm's still a little. I couldn't quite do that. In our lineage, we have 4 ceremonies. And some of you might know this, but I'm going over it. So, the first one I mentioned is the Jukai, which is the lay Buddhist initiation. So, if you want to formally enter the stream of Buddhism, you can get initiated. And you get one of these rakusus that people are wearing around, and you get a name, and you get papers. You get a paper, a lineage paper. And on the lineage paper, I love the lineage papers, it says, Shakyamuni gave it to Mahakashapa. Mahakashapa gave it to Ananda. Gave it to this person. Gave it to that person. Gave it to this person. I'm the 83rd generation. We had to count. So it goes all the way down, and at the bottom it says Katagiri Roshi gave it to Joen, Joen gave it to Byakuren, and Byakuren gives it to Onryu. Is that your name? Tenryu. And there's stamps. I put stamps on it, and it's a formal paper. It's a certificate or a document, like when you go to grad college, you get a paper when you graduate. And most people, that's the ceremony they do. They become a Buddhist, and then they just practice for the rest of their life. Something that I don't think is obvious about clouds and water is that it's partially because Zen is quite new in America. It's only, I think it was in the 50s that it really started to go, so that's 60 years. And it first came in 1890, the Chicago World's Fair. A Zen teacher came to the Chicago World's Fair. That's one of the beginning. Of course, there were Buddhists that were immigrant Buddhists. So, for example, the Japanese who came to work on the railroads, you know, when we were building railroads, there was a big Japanese contingent that, Japanese or Chinese, probably Chinese now that I'm thinking about it, but Asians came over. And, of course, they were Buddhists mostly at that time. But when, in the 50s, I'm mostly talking about non-immigrants, converts, when this started. And why did I bring that up? Oh, because we don't have any institutions. It's only been around 60 years. So as far as I know, there's no place to go to be trained as a priest like the other religions have. You know, you go to seminary or you go here or you go there, and you go for 3 or 4 years, and then you come out with the certificate. And then you get to do something with the congregation or be a chaplain. And we don't have that yet. I mean, there's plenty of people working on that. We don't even have a centralized organization, although we're working on it. The Japanese Central, the Sodoshu in Tokyo, they have a very hard time recognizing Westerners because of their culture. And there are a few, I would say maybe 50 Americans are recognized by the Sodoshu, which means that you did most of your training in Japan and you dotted every I and crossed every T. And then you get a certain level of priest. We just, Americans or Western Hemisphere, I think they call it the Western anyway. It includes Europe and South America. We're just getting together these organizations. And the one that I belong to, SZBA, Soto Zen Buddhist Association. They have a conference every other year, and Sosan and I and Joen and people go to it. And they're just now making decisions about what is Zen in America and what is the criterion of becoming a Zen teacher and what's your training and how much do you have to go to a monastery and all these details. And they really, it's so slow, you wouldn't believe how slow it is, because everyone is so opinionated, right? So we have to get a group conscience to make any decisions about it. So it's very slow. Even ethically, we needed a national ethical board. Well, Clouds and Water needed one, whenever that was, 15 years ago or 20 years ago. And we don't even have that yet, where you can go and say a teacher is behaving unethically and what should we do. The other religions do have that. Whether they work or not is another issue, but they do have them. So we're a little behind. So what you may not realize is that Clouds and Water is also a training center. We're training priests. And that's why different people get up here. And sometimes it's people that have never given a talk before or are learning how to give a Dharma talk, because we're training them on how to keep the Zen tradition going. Because there's no place to go except these small sanghas all over the place. So if you would like to start like a formal training to become a priest or a teacher, then there's other ceremonies. First is priest ordination, and we might be coming up to one or two new people wanting to train so that they can teach Buddhism or run a center or be a leader in the community. And that's also, they have to sew a robe, it's a whole, they have to be in relationship with the Zen teacher, and there's quite a bit of processing to do about what does it mean to be a priest and why do you want to do it. Then the second ceremony, the one I really love, Shuso ceremony, it's called head monk ceremony or head priest, but head practitioner ceremony, because we've done lay Shuso ceremonies as well as priest Shuso ceremonies. And that ceremony is the teacher's there, but the teacher's not as important. It's a ceremony between the community and the priest or the person. The community asks questions. It's a community, the community saying, we accept you as a leader. Isn't that great? It's the whole community is giving the ordination in a Shuso ceremony. And the community is giving an invitation to lead, that you can, we want you to lead. We trust you. We care about you. We want you to keep going. That's a Shuso ceremony. And again, as I say, there are no cut and fast rules. In San Francisco Zen Center, you really can't teach or see people until you've done the Shuso ceremony. Of course, they're a huge center and they have lots of teachers. But we can't do that, because whoever is pretty mature has to give talks, has to see people. So we often do it before that you're teaching, before Shuso. But it's a big ceremony of the community saying that they want you to lead. And the last ceremony, the one I've been talking about, transmission, is the ceremony that is the close of your training. You've done enough training, and now you can actually be a teacher. And you get a brown robe. You'll notice Fish has a brown robe. And Kyoku is going to have transmission, I think, in November. And Ken had it last year. Sosan had it about 3 years ago or 4 years ago. I had it about 8 years ago. So we were a training institution, and now some of our students are graduating. And it's very cool because you hand make your certificates. So it took us 5 days for Fish to hand calligraphy 3 different pieces of paper that say that she's a certified Zen teacher. One's a lineage paper, one's a paper about the content of the teaching, and one's a paper about the simultaneity of all the ancestors. So it's a week-long ceremony, making all the certificates and then doing two ceremonies at night. And I don't know if any of you were here, but we make a completely red room for one ceremony and a white room for another ceremony. So as we're going through this, and now I've transmitted to four people or something like that, I'm starting to transmit. And they say that your transmission really isn't finished until you've transmitted to someone else. Right? It's got to go through. Or otherwise your lineage dies. And it's really hard to get someone to the level they need to be to get transmitted. No one I have transmitted, all of those people I've known for over 10 years, even 15 years. So it's longer than seminary, right? That's a long time to really intimately know someone. And I feel like the people I've transmitted to, well, Ken I've known for 30 years, but everyone else. And Jeff and Kyoku they came from the previous clouds. But I was there too. So I've known them for quite a long time. And we've been through this pretty hard thing together. So it's really an exciting time for me and for them that this is happening, that the training has actually ended. It was like with children's practice that three of the kids did Jukai this last time. It was like, oh, we did something. We took these children from 4 years old or whenever we start to get them, and a couple of them became Buddhists. It was very satisfying this last Jukai that some of the people, kids from children practice, were doing Jukai. So the next harder thing is, when should somebody be transmitted? So there's a fantasy about transmission, and there's a practical reality about transmission. So I love fantasy. And I've lived in the Buddhist community a lot with a lot of fantasies about, oh, once you're enlightened, you never suffer again. And what is enlightenment anyway? And that you have to be very strict about transmission, that it's a mind-to-mind transmission of Buddha's mind to Buddha's mind. And I like that. That's wonderful. Let it be so. Buddha's mind to Buddha's mind. But there's a lot of other things that have to happen for a transmission to be good, to be wholesome, to produce good results. And so as we've been going, we started to make a list of what happens when someone is ready to be transmitted. And I'll tell you, I've never known anyone who feels ready to be transmitted. Myself included, everyone I know feels that they're not good enough. So part of transmission, it seems to me, is owning what you know and owning that you're good enough to teach with your faults and imperfections, with your weaknesses and with your strengths. And we all have weaknesses, for sure. And I'll tell you, when you teach, your weaknesses are public. Your whole community knows your weaknesses. They also know your strengths. In my case, I'm just now understanding my strengths because I was so hung up on my weaknesses. But everybody needs to be confident. And I have found this last ceremony pushes people to be confident in what they are, who they know, and how deeply their vow goes in their life. So the first one is that, so this is from the teacher's point of view, am I confident that these people are truly living by vow? And we fail sometimes and we succeed, but are they consistently living by vow? Do they have the correct understanding of the teaching? A non-dualistic understanding of the teaching. And we wrote down going beyond the magic city. So that's from the Lotus Sutra, if you studied the Lotus Sutra. The magic city is maybe I would say about a third of the way into training. You start to get a lot of beauty in your sitting. Rapture or bliss or you start to have visions. This is called the magic city. And it's written in the Lotus Sutra. But there's a whole two-thirds of the training is after the magic. You have to leave the magic city. And you have to go out and work really, really hard. The magic city is there to inspire you, to encourage you, but it's not the destination. When I look at someone to get transmitted, I want to make sure that they've left the magic city. Because if they're in the magic city, a lot of harm can happen. It's not a grounded practice. So, the next one is awareness of your personal neurosis. So, my fantasy was that when I got transmitted, my psychological issues would be cleaned up. And I would not make a mistake. And I would not go into shame or whatever my neuroses are again. Well, that's just not the way it is. That's not being a human being. It's not like and even the saints still had their neurosis. You know, Mother Teresa was sainted, and you can read in her writing that she had a lot of difficulty in her life. A lot of difficulty. And she had a lot of lack of faith or doubt, even as a saint. But what's really important if you get into a leadership position at a religious institution is you at least have to know your neurosis, and you have to have explored the shadow parts of yourself, because otherwise they go into the culture of the temple or the center and bad things happen. And we've unfortunately Clouds and Water has learned that through our history. So it's very important for me that one of my heirs really understands themselves psychologically and knows the tools for adjusting the problem. And that we know how to apologize and make amends. To me, that's really important. Grandmotherly mind. As we were studying for transmission, we were reading about Dogen and Dogen's transmissions. And, you know, I didn't look up the story, so this is from my memory, so it won't be that great. But one of his students who ran the temple, did a lot of work, was the Tenzo, and their new temple, they didn't have a kitchen. So they had to cook at a practitioner's house and carry the food up to the temple. Talk about hard work. We all know that Tenzo's really hard work. And they had to carry the food up the hill to get to the temple. So this guy had done a tremendous amount of work for Dogen, had followed Dogen, gone to all of his lectures, and Dogen would not transmit to him. This is at the end of Dogen's life. Dogen transmit to someone else and said he wouldn't transmit to this guy, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. And Dogen said to him, "You don't have enough grandmotherly mind. You aren't kind enough or soft enough or compassionate enough. And until that happens for you, that softening, I don't want to transmit to you." And then Dogen died, and Dogen's heir did finally transmit to this man after some kind of change had occurred for him, after this criticism that he was too harsh or tight or something like that. So then we added grandmotherly mind after we read that story. And familiarity with cessation. So this goes to the question about what is enlightenment? And am I enlightened? And I can go through all those people. Are they enlightened? Do we experience them as enlightened? So maybe 4 or 5 years ago, the teacher Rio decided that we were going to study Dogen's fascicles on enlightenment. And it's been a wonderful process for me. It really brought me to a different place in my spiritual life by studying what Dogen said about enlightenment. And basically he says it's a process of becoming a mature, capable, stable, correct knowledge, and trustworthy human being. And included in that process is this idea of dropping off body and mind, which is what we classically, in my fantasy, I say, oh, an enlightened person is someone who's dropped off body and mind. So I've studied that for years. But now, because I'm in the process of doing these transmissions from one flawed human being to another flawed human being, I keep saying, what are we doing? What are we doing here if we're still flawed? And I realize now, and I read through, it's a long kind of convoluted, Shohaku has it in his book, and it's about Dogen, and it's about Dogen's teacher. And Dogen's teacher was the person who coined the phrase dropping off body and mind that we hear all through Dogen's literature. And so I started reading, what did he actually say, Dogen's teacher, about what dropping off body and mind means? And I have given talks on this in the last few years previous. But what I understand it to mean now is there's a continuum of grossly dropping off body and mind, medium to very, very subtle. And whenever you do it, whether gross, in the middle, or subtle, it is dropping off body and mind. And what dropping off body and mind means is you are not acting self centered. That's what it means. Now, grossly, that means any act that isn't done because it benefits yourself. I mean, sometimes you do acts that benefit yourself, but solely, greed, anger, and ignorance is, you know, when you drop off greed, anger, and ignorance in any part of your life, that is an enlightened moment. That is enlightenment. You're dropping off your self-centered way of perceiving the world. In the subtlest way, during Zazen mostly, you actually have an experience where your body is fluid or dissolved, your mind is quiet, where you drop off body and mind. But that is just the subtle end of the continuum. And what I got mostly from Dogen studying Daigo, or Great Realization, is enlightenment is not an event. It's not something that happens to you when you're 54 or whatever, you're, you know, 43 or 38, and it goes ping, and then your life has changed and you don't have to do any more work. And your neuroses are completely taken away, and you're this fantasy of a free person. Even if you look at Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama and Katagiri Roshi and Reb Anderson and people that I think have devoted their entire life to learning what it means to not be self-centered, to be universal consciousness, they still have a lot of flaws. These men, and also women. So, it is a continuous process. Continually, day by day process of noticing when you're forming the universe around yourself. And the moment you let go of that is a moment of enlightenment. And the more familiar you are, the more, I like the word familiarity, the Tibetans use that word a lot, the more it's in your blood to do it that way, the more enlightened you are. But it has to be a continuous process. And it happens every single day. Because when I wake up in the morning, for the most part, I'm self-centered. I want what I want, and I want it right now. Then I get up, and I do my sitting, and I do this ritual we just did this morning, and I chant the names of the ancestors, or whatever I do in the morning. By the time I'm done with that, my mind has changed. And now I'm practicing my vows. And if I can keep that consciousness as I go through the day, my life starts to change. Morning. What's my morning like? How do I want to show up for my morning? Can I let go of the results of my effort? All the things we practice. Can I do a 3-breath meditation and remember that my to-do list isn't that important? Right? All these things, mindfulness practices and meditating and all the things that we do to remember our vows and to place ourselves in a universal perspective. That's enlightenment. And it's the best we can do. And as we mature, I think we can start to hold that longer and longer, even though we're still human beings and we still have neurotic tendencies. But I think I have matured in public, let me say. I have matured. So that's a sign of a continuously working on myself and continuously trying to shift my mind from a tight, selfish outlook, frustrated, dissatisfied outlook, to a gratitude and open and present moment and trusting my life and not afraid of death, all the things that we work on. And I think you learn how to hold the new paradigm, if for lack of a better word, more and more. So then I can say to Fish and Ken and Jeff, this ceremony of transmission, we drop our neurosis in order to do it. We drop our I'm not good enough. We drop our I don't know what I'm doing. All those doubts and very self-concerned psychological stuff, you drop them. And you bring forth as much as you know about Buddha in yourself. And that's who does the ceremony. My Buddha self. Even though I know that Judith Regeer is in there somewhere. And mostly Judith Regeer says, I don't want to do this. That's my voice inside myself. I even had it with this lecture. I was driving over. I don't want to do this. Poor dear. Because she does a lot she doesn't want to do. And so do you, right? So do you. But if I can pivot that voice into my practice voice, I'm very resilient. I get here, today, boy, I made the breakfast, I did the service, I'm giving the talk. And I'll go home and that little voice will say, oh, thank God that's over. Do you know what I mean? There's that voice. And you have to just practice with that voice continuously. And bring forth your Buddha nature, which we all have. So I think we have a couple of minutes if anyone wants to make a statement or ask a question. Yes. Thank you. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just appreciate the ritual. It's one of the things I think that I appreciated yesterday when we did session. We talked about bowing and just even that, just even watching someone bow with attention, is a beautiful thing. And
you know, I got out off of bowing. I used to love to bow. And then I've had a couple of years where, Maybe it's because my knees hurt. Certain things are going on, you know, I didn't want to bow. But this transmission, I so much want to bow now. I have so much gratitude. Oh my God, I am filled with gratitude from doing this transmission. And to think, one thing Fish told me, you know, she's been bowing to these ancestors. And you begin to understand, each ancestor spent their whole life preserving the rituals and making sure someone younger than them knew them. And then the next guy, there's a few girls now on it, but, you know, wow. I just feel flooded with gratitude. And the bow is a wonderful embodied expression of gratitude. Yeah.
Not so concerned about my personality, my defects, but this wave of, or like night and day, or like seasons, as I come through those things, not grasping nor resisting, that I find myself in a flow that is much more, I'm much more available to be compassionate. Mm.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, you talk about ancestors. I thought it might be you can strengthen your practice by visiting some of the sacred sites, like Lambini there, where the Buddha was born, Kathmandu, do a pilgrimage around the Holy Mountains, you know, the Muslims are, have the Hajj. Catholics are like to want to visit the Vatican. And the Jews here return to the homeland. Buddhists there, I think it should be extremely dedicated to go back to the origin of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I think that you gain a lot of appreciation of visiting these sites.
Well, Fish and Ken have recently gone. Fish went to India and Ken went to China. And so did Lee Lewis. So they're going to be teaching. Lee Lewis and Ken are going to be teaching about the Chinese ancestors from their trips of visiting the sites this fall. I've never had the opportunity to go, partially because I'm a mom, and also because I spend so much time away from my family doing sesshins that I haven't taken a month or something to go on the pilgrimage. But I agree with you, something happens when you go to these sites.
Well, I think you really appreciate the dedication some of these, these Buddhists have there in their religion there. They would prostrate themselves there.
All the way up the mountain.
All the way up the mountain.
Yeah. Oh, GD has gone also. She has wonderful stories about Mount Kailash. Yeah. Didi.
One thing, talking about the ceremony is, I remember early on when I first came here trying to understand some of this, you know, I wasn't so keen on the ceremony, but I do remember a talk, I think it was either a talk or maybe a book by Rev Anderson talking about form.
Right.
It was very clear that he felt that form was important. And he talks about it, well, the way I understood it was as kind of a, as a, like a, almost like a receptacle that of safety. It's safe, and in that way, you can open yourself up to the larger universal. Because you can get rid of that fear of being, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about that. You enter this space that's safe. And you create it through the forms that you do. So bowing. And I, in children's practice, you can kind of see that. It's like the kind of know the candle and the lighting. They don't get it all the time, but they just know that this is now the... You can see it. They can feel it. They look kind of like...
They relax. Or, Yeah, Rebecca. How did you feel about Jukai? Did it do that for you, or what? You haven't done it. Oh, I thought you had. Well, you can think about it then. I don't push anybody to do ceremonies because I know that Americans have a kind of love-hate. So you just do it when it's the right timing in your life, if it ever is. But as you both were saying, these ceremonies we do in our life provide us with structure, spiritual structure. I'm very into spiritual structure. Otherwise, a couple days go by and I realize I haven't thought about it. That's not what I want in my life. I want to think about it every day, my vows. Yes?
The ceremony is kind of a two-edged sword. In most of, you know, I've gone through, this is my third religion. So my understanding of it is what ceremony does sometimes is to, as long as you do the ceremony and then it's okay. You don't have to go deeper. When I went to Jukai, that's the first religion where this and I finally realized this is just the surface. So the ceremony is the surface, but then you want to go into it more. And so I didn't fall into the regular habit of my previous religion, but as long as I do the ceremony, I'm okay. But in this way, Dukai inspired me to study more. It was just the beginning of that.
Right.
Something deeper in this religion.
Right.
Right.
And I think transmission is the same. We say it's completing your training, but in my experience, it was the beginning of a big kind of depth leap. I had to make a leap to do the next maturing. And I feel it's endlessly leaping to get to the next level of trusting the universe, or letting go, or not controlling. For me, every day I have to make that leap. And but as you practice making the leap, you see you don't die, or it turns out good, letting go. So then you're more likely to leap. That's how trust builds on itself. Okay, I think we're done.